Brexit took a remarkable twist this week, leaving us all, well, discombobulated.
What's prorogue? Why is the Queen involved? What is Brexit? How do you spell backstop? Is it two words? I don't know anything. It's too confusing. Where is the government? Why hasn't the Taoiseach been on the radio yet to tell us everything's fine? Tell us we're grand. It's a crisis. Next door has gone mad.
Like a cross between an EastEnders Christmas special and the darkest episode of Black Mirror. Well, we will not go there yet. Relax. It's only 9:10 on a Saturday after all, so time enough. Let's ease our way into the day with a little bit of this, a little bit of kittens, a little bit of baking. What could be more relaxing? And ahead of the return of the bake-off across the water, Jarlath Killeen from Trinity College spoke to Irina's Kay Sheehy about pastry and pies in literature, and in particular, the rise of the meat pie and its depiction by Dickens in the Pickwick Papers.
Mr. Pickwick is an extremely innocent individual, and he sees these meat pies, veal pies, being displayed in a shop window, and he thinks they look delicious. But his companion, Sam Welder, who's a Cockney who knows the city quite well, tells him, you need to be a bit careful here. Meat pies are very well if you know the lady has made them, he informs Mr. Pickwick. But when you don't know who made them, it could well be that you'd find kittens being transformed through seasoning into tasting like meat.
Kittens.
Kittens is what he focuses on. Kittens is in season in the Pickwick Papers. But you disguise the kittens by adding a lot of seasoning. So he tells Mr. Pickwick he knows of a baker who used to do this. Sometimes it was kittens, sometimes it might be birds, sometimes it might be little puppies. And you just disguise it through seasoning.
Fantastic. Disgusting. I didn't know what would be in it, but I didn't think it would
but
be
he said
kittens.
He does say that the pies are delicious.
Ooh, slathered in a bit of gravy here, kitty, 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 kitty. That was Irina on Monday with a slice of kitten pie, which I imagine is still easier to digest than a Brexit Battenberg. The Sisterhood, Feminism and Mammies featured on Pantisocracy this week.
My mother never burned her bra. She's much too frugal to burn a perfectly good bra. And anyway, she needed her bras to manage her warm, hefty mammy breasts. My mother did not get the train to Belfast with a noisy gang of women and return later the same day with fists full of condoms to be greeted at Connolly Station by a flanks of Gardaí and press photographers. I don't ever remember my mother reading Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan, and she definitely wasn't on the pill. And I don't really recall her ever describing herself as a feminist or, well, a women's libber.
And although Panty's mammy might not have identified herself as a feminist, the way that she lived was an exercise in equality and efficiency.
Six kids, two dogs and a cat squeezed into a Volkswagen Beetle brown bread in the oven. Connick, secretary of the community games managing the credit union. She could have been anything she wanted to be, my mother, in different circumstances, in a different time. And she was too smart to not sometimes be annoyed by that. My three sisters inherited many of my mother's traits. They're hardworking, kind, selfless, reliable, principled, no-nonsense. I've always wanted to be more like the admirable women in my life. My three sisters grew up in a different time from my mother, a different country, with opportunities my mother could only have dreamed of. My sisters could have been almost anything they wanted to be, and they were, though in many respects what they wanted to be was just like our mother.
Panty on the mammy. And she was joined by first wave feminist Rosita Sweetman, and she talked about her own mother.
Your mother was a liberal sort of woman, certainly in her time.
She was educated in England, which I think was a huge thing. She didn't have that politeness or total cravenness towards the Catholic Church.
Mm, the Protestants got to her. Yeah.
You know, I remember being expelled from school, coming home, you know, in absolute terror, and Mum just said, did you do it? It was the first time anyone had asked me that. I said, no. And she just marched me straight back, take her back, you know.
And had you done it?
No, I haven't actually, no.
Oh, the injustice of it. But what about the resurgence of women describing themselves as feminists, in marked contrast to attitudes in the 1980s and 90s, when, frankly, the F word was not to be uttered?
It was almost killed off, I think, feminism, during, say, neoliberalism, you know, when... Yep. Everything was money worship. then feminism did become a dirty word. Mm. Particularly young women were afraid to say, should I say I'm a feminist, you know? Whereas now it's everybody wants to be a feminist. Well, all the good people.
Rosita Sweetman on Pantisocracy. Well, if sisterhood and mother is featured then, unlike family, the focus was fathers, and in particular, new fathers. Here's Andrew with 18-day-old baby Penny.
I'm tired. See, this is it, Brenda. Like, when she cries, there's really only 4 or 5 reasons why she is crying. So it's a case of trying to figure out which one it is. Now, we know she's not hungry because we just gave her bottles. There's the evidence. She's gotten her burps up, so we're confident it's not wind. She might need to be changed, but my guess is she's just tired. Yeah. And she's trying to figure out how to sleep. That's the tricky one. I think in the first few days, like, you panic. Yeah. You know, when the baby starts crying, like, you're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? How do we make this stop? But then you understand that, like, you just grow. You learn to understand that babies are going to cry and they're actually fine.
Oh, mommy's coming to stay.
And how has the 2-week paternity leave been for the family?
When my dad was my age and he was having children, he was back in work the next day. So and that was it. That was just a given. There was no extended paternity leave. Whereas I've had the luxury of being able to take in the full 2 weeks paternity leave. So it's nice to have that time to get to know your baby.
Was there a moment where you went, "Oh my God, I'm a dad"?
When the baby is born that night, you get sent home. So Michelle is in the hospital alone with Penny, and you come home, and you're coming home to an empty house, and you do that 2 nights in a row. But then on the third night is when it really kicks home, because that's when you're in your own house and you're here as a family. So when you come back and there's no midwives that you can call on, there's no emergency button that you can press, there's no help at the end of a shout or anything like that, that's when it really kicks home. That's like, oh my God, I'm a dad, we're a family, it's up to us now.
Andrew speaking to Brenda Donoghue on Like Family. And Ray Darcy was also having a bit of a dad moment.
And I was thinking, when did I first start to feel it? I don't think I feel like a parent. There wasn't one moment. Of course, there's the moment when you're in the delivery ward and when you're there and, you know, the baby comes out and you're handed the baby after it's cleaned up and you're standing there and you're looking into their eyes and you're thinking to yourself, I'm responsible for this little human being for the rest of my life. And that's a moment. But after that, I don't know. And I remember saying to Kate when I was holding her in my arms for about an hour, I think, you know, while Jenny was getting fixed up, whatever you say, because it was a cesarean. And I actually said to her in the nursery, I said, "Do you recognise my voice?" There was a man there and he looked up to me and he said, he's probably thinking to himself, "Ah, look at him. Do you recognise my voice? Who does he think he is? The man from the radio?" But I was thinking to myself, well, obviously I'd been talking. Well, the baby was in Jenny's womb.
Never too early to get those listeners, Ray. Well, the crisis in the beef industry escalated this week as protests from the beef plan movement continued despite High Court injunctions, with farmers maintaining that they are simply not getting enough money for their cattle. On Tuesday's Drive Time, reporter John Cook met a protester outside the Keepak plant in Drumquin, outside Ennis in County Clare.
Will you give me your own name, sir? Well,
that's the funny part about this interview, you know. It would probably be unsafe for me to give my name. Yeah. It's like, we are the small men on the ground. We're the slaves on the ground. All I want to do is rear my family. I have a medium-sized farm. I have about 140 cattle between cows and calves. I start and I finish my cattle. All I want to do is make a profit, make a living. If it continues as it is, I will not be in farming in a year's time. I'll have to sell all of my stock just to pay my bills, and then I'm out of farming. That's how close to the end this is.
Are you afraid that factories won't do business with you if you're known as one of the protesters?
I'm not afraid of the factories. The factories have me killed. My little children here with me today. My kids.
You have 2 daughters there with you.
I have 2 daughters. I had 3. I had 4 kids in total here yesterday because they were not going back to school. My family is going to leave the country because I'll have to leave the farm and find some work someplace else, because I won't be able to afford to pay for school books. I'm broke. And if I let this go any deeper, I want to stop farming now before it goes too bad, before it gets too bad for me. As an individual, I can sell the rest of my stock, not finish any more cattle, and get out, walk out of it, without getting being broke. If I finish two more lots of cattle, of just 14 or 15 cattle, I'm not talking about big bunches of cattle. If I finish them and I can't pay for the nuts to finish them, I'm broke. It's as simple as that. So what these factories do or say to me, I don't care. But it's the corporate greed that governs these factories that can bully me into being afraid to give my name. Because if they decide to put an injunction on me, what chance have I? They'll take my farm off me. That's the type of pressure I'm under. I'm standing here in front of you and I'm in my stomach is on fire with stress and pain and worry. That's where I am at the moment.
A beef farmer is heard on Drive Time on Tuesday. This week saw the announcement of a rollout of the HPV vaccine to boys as well as girls, all starting next month. Chief Executive of the Irish Cancer Society, Avril Power, spoke to Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland.
We have an opportunity here, and it's really quite remarkable, to eliminate a whole form of cancer. The vaccine is safe, it's effective, it's recommended by the World Health Organization.
It's been
really
tried and tested to more than 200 million doses, hasn't it? I mean,
it really has. Yeah. Like, this is probably the most tested vaccine ever. And I think one of the alarming things, look, and as an independent patient body in the Irish Cancer Society, our only concern is patients and people affected by cancer. We're completely independent. We wouldn't put our name behind something unless we felt very strongly that it was safe and it was the right thing to do. And I think people, I would just urge listeners to listen to us on this, to talk to your doctor, to make sure that if you get advice that it's from a medical professional. There's all kinds of crazy stuff on the internet, and I think every parent wants to do what's right for their child, and sometimes you come across this kind of crazy stuff online, and you know, creates enough of a seed of doubt that parents will might not get the vaccine. But if you got onto a plane and saw that there was a non-pilot sitting there that was on their first flight, you'd get off the plane. Like, don't take medical advice from somebody who's not a trained doctor, because the medical community are all of the one mind on this, that this is safe and it's an absolute must for parents to protect their kids.
Avril Power of the Irish Cancer Society with Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland. And later that day, Kevin Brennan spoke to Ray Darcy about his sister Laura, an advocate for the HPV vaccine, who had died in March of this year from cervical cancer at the age of 26.
It's a real bittersweet occasion for us as a family. You know, it was it's real progressive news that the vaccine has been rolled out to boys this coming year. Mm. And it was some very, very kind and touching words spoken about Laura and her contribution towards the recent increase in the uptake. But she'd have loved being there. We'd have loved if she was there, and her loss today was felt.
And Kevin reminded us of Laura's decision to use her time to campaign for the vaccine.
2 weeks after she received that terminal diagnosis, she popped on Facebook and sent the HSE a private message telling them of her story and saying if there's anything she could do to help increase vaccination rates, she was more than willing to do so. Mm. At the time, vaccination rates had plummeted to 51%, and I suppose on the back of her work and the work of others, a week before she passed away, she was thrilled to announce that vaccination rates had reached 70%.
So there's no doubt in anybody's mind that Laura's work has saved lives or will save lives in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose when she got involved in the campaign at the start, we as a family said, well, if it helped one person out there, it would all be worthwhile. But the facts and the figures would state that she's helped countless others.
Kevin Brennan, brother of the late Laura Brennan, with Ray on Tuesday. Pianist Hugh Tinney came into Studio 8 for Arena and performed the Harp Etude by Chopin. And here's a little taster from that performance.
Thank you.
Harpétude from Chopin, performed by Hugh Tinney, as heard on Arena. So what did hyenas nibble on when they pottered around Ireland? Nigel Monaghan from the Natural History Museum, or the Dead Zoo, was tripping over himself to tell Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday, and clearly he was a man who revelled in his work.
And we know that that hyena was not only in Ireland, but it was eating woolly mammoth. I got a woolly mammoth with dimples in there that are where the teeth went from a hyena. And a little special item in a box here that shows that not only did the hyena get some woolly mammoth in the front end, but from the back end of the hyena.
Yes. This is a little box with what looks like a little granite stone.
But it looks like a very unhappy golf ball.
It does, actually. And is it?
And it's been all the way through a hyena and out the other end. And it's basically hyena poo made up almost entirely of bone fragments that the hyena couldn't quite digest.
How old is this?
And if you look really close, yes, there's little fibres of hair. And in a few years' time, with the right technology, we could probably actually get the DNA out of that hair and tell you what that hyena ate. It probably ate a woolly mammoth. And it's about 35,000 years old. It's my favourite piece of poo in the museum.
Because there are so many contenders, clearly. But just how healthy is the state of taxidermy on this island?
The skill is one that tends to be a personal handcraft. You have to teach yourself this thing, and that's where quality can be an issue. But over years and years and years with long family firms, and we've worked with firms with four generations of the family all doing taxidermy.
Yes.
An extended family where Maurice can do the giraffe for us and Leon's pretty good with the birds, and they have an aunt who restores leather hides and so on. So you need big extended family firms, basically, or you need to employ your own long-term taxidermist. And we haven't had that in the museum. Okay. For almost 100 years.
Really?
There used to be a guy with a leather apron, big beard in the old pictures. That was our taxidermist. And he took things out the back.
Out the back. That sounds ominous. And walking through the museum itself can be quite the experience.
How many creatures are there?
Well, there's about 10,000 exhibits in that space, apart from all the stuff we have behind the scenes and research collections. There's 10,000 animals following you with more than 10,000 pairs of eyes, because, you know, there's spiders and things with more eyes than two. When you see it initially as a kid, and a lot of people their first experience of this is as a kid, they're walking up. We see toddlers going up trying to feed the ducks and banging their heads on the glass. Yeah. And we see kids that are going from their first board book of animals into, oh, wow, it's in 3D and it's this big and I can stand beside it. And that initial fascination with animals is there in all children. They all are fascinated by the creepy crawlies.
The Natural History Museum's Nigel Monaghan with Ryan. Now, have you sharpened your pencils, covered your copybooks? Because excitement, it's back to school time. And yes, I appreciate that for many people this is a time of dread. Not for all. For some of us, it was a beloved time. Teacher, more homework. Loved it. But let's not forget about the other person in the classroom. Yes, we have the pupils, but what about the teacher? Sunday Miscellany featured retired teacher Conal Hamill.
One of the uncomfortable truths of the teacher's life is that each school year, you return to the classroom 1 year older, but the pupils seated in front of you are always the same age. As your teaching career progresses and you move irrevocably through your 40s and 50s towards your 60s, your first year pupils are permanently stuck at the second of Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man. There they are, every year, with their satchels and shiny morning faces and that boundless energy, while you, now with fair round belly and spectacles on nose, can only contemplate a future sans teeth, sans eyes, and make a note to check your health insurance. Sisyphus would have had no problem understanding what it's like being a teacher with 30 or 40 years' experience. As the age gap widens between you and your pupils, and Yeats's view that an aged man is but a paltry thing takes on an uncomfortable immediacy for you, it's healthy to be reminded that 30 of the 31 people in the classroom don't care much about Yeats's or your angst about human frailty. Their concerns are more immediate. How can I avoid detention for not having my French homework? How can I skip to the top of the lunch queue? What's happening in Game of Thrones? And that's as it should be. As the years slipped by, the more I felt that while being able to introduce pupils to The Great Gatsby or the poetry of Seamus Heaney was an enormous pleasure, the real privilege lay in being able to simply witness young people being young. And as my years slipped away, more and more, I envied them all the time they had ahead of them.
Conal Hamill on Sunday Miscellany. However, the return to school can be extremely challenging for some families. Louise Tobin is principal at St. Joseph's Primary School in Tipperary Town, an unemployment black spot, and she spoke about pupils coming to school hungry and poorly nourished.
I certainly have seen children coming with a lunchbox with 10 plain biscuits. I have seen children coming with what I would describe as, you know, not a nutritious lunch, you know, maybe a pan of chocolate from Aldi, maybe a bag of popcorn. But, you know, you'd see children in the morning taking out their lunchbox and eating something on the playground. They would be starving for their break time at 10:45. While parents are doing their best, you know, maybe they don't know the nutritional value of food. I mean, sometimes I find it challenging myself, but, you know, that these people need extra supports when they live in a disadvantaged community.
They have access to a state-funded breakfast club, but that boils down to spending 60 cent per child, which translates into the following.
So when the children arrive in school, in their classroom, there would be a big tray of, let's say, soft cheese, and in another tray would be a plain rice cake, and that's what they get. I mean, it is not enough. It is, okay, it's healthy and it's nutritional, but it certainly wouldn't feed any child or address a child that had not had their breakfast in the morning. It just isn't enough.
So it's astonishing. The department thinks that 60 cent is enough money to give a child a nutritious breakfast.
Absolutely. Two item morning snack, 60 cent.
And the effect of this poor nutrition, this hunger, is obvious in the classroom.
You can't concentrate. Your memory isn't functioning and you're lethargic in school. So in fact, these children cannot access their education unless they have a proper nutritionist breakfast, lunch.
And on that, Louise, I mean, most of the parents, they do their very best, you know. Could they get advice from a dietitian or a nutritionist, you know, substitute cheese for the pastry, substitute yogurt for the bag of crisps? Could that advice be given?
Of course it could, Miriam. And I mean, we have a healthy lunches policy. But at the end of the day, when you have people trying to make ends meet, going into the supermarket, trying to make the 40 euro stretch and feed their children as best they can, it's a big challenge. I mean, you know, we all know healthy nutrition is a big challenge. And at the same time, Marion, you want the children to eat something, you know, and fussy eaters, etc. So I really think, you know, the individualised lunch club is what we need, and we need it very soon.
Principal Louise Tobin with Miriam. All summer, A.B. Philbin Bowman has been probing the psyche of a much maligned species, politicians, for the title of his series, Humans of Politics. And yes, he tells us that TDs have feelings too. No, really, honest. And this week, Paddy Tobin talked about joining Sinn Féin and leaving Sinn Féin. First, the joining.
The funny thing is, if you ask a person, what would be the main ingredient that makes a person decide what political party they're in? Most people would say, I'm sure it's policy, or I'm sure it's competency, or this type of stuff. I'll tell you, one of the main issues that has people in political parties today is simply their friendships.
Then the leaving.
Is it a bit like having a row with an ex?
I would say, now, and I probably haven't said this before, but that was probably one of the most difficult things that has happened on a personal basis over the last number of years. I would have had a lot of people who were very close friends, comrades. Like, Sinn Féin is a party on its own, and because of its experience and because of, let's say, it's us against the rest of the world type instinct, there is a very tight-knit relationship. Other political parties do not have that deep level of interdependence that exists in a party like Sinn Féin. So when you're in an organisation like that for 21 years and then you're torn out of it to a certain extent, it becomes really, really difficult. And it would have been easily one of the toughest things. I would have a lot of people that, you know, are not speaking to me whatsoever, even still. Now, on the flip side of that, there's a lot of decent people within the organisation who are very warm and friendly as well. But yeah, it'd be hard for me to overemphasise how difficult that whole experience was.
Paddy Tobin with A.B. Philbin Bowman on the series Humans of Politics. Now, one politician who's frankly rarely troubled by doubt is Donald Trump, top of his class at the School of Superlatives. He was in Biarritz last weekend for the G7 summit, and naturally, when it comes to the environment, sure, there's nothing he doesn't know.
We're the number one energy producer in the world. Soon it will be by far the number one. And I'm not going to lose that wealth. I'm not going to lose it on dreams, on windmills, which, frankly, aren't working too well. I'm not going to lose it. So I want the cleanest water on Earth. I want the cleanest air on Earth. And that's what we're doing. And I'm an environmentalist. A lot of people don't understand that. I have done more environmental impact statements probably than anybody that's, I guess I can say definitely, because I've done many, many, many of them, more than anybody that's ever been president or vice president or anything even close to president. And I think I know more about the environment than most people.
However, World Affairs editor with The Guardian, Julian Borger, spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time on Monday from that summit, and it transpired there was a meeting on climate change happening, which, given Trump's expertise, you'd think he'd be chairing the whole thing. But no.
He didn't turn up. There was an empty chair during the session on climate change and biodiversity. He was meeting Merkel and then Narendra Modi of India. And he had a quarter of an hour in between, but he didn't turn up to that meeting. And that's par for the course for the Trump administration. Since leaving the Paris Climate Accord, they have refused to sign any G7 common document about climate change. He is very much in the climate denier camp.
Drive Time on Monday. And now a little gear change.
The 2019 International Rose of Tralee is Limerick! Well done, Sinead. Congratulations. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Thank you. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah.
Are you surprised and shocked?
Yeah, I think you can tell by me. I'm a bit shocked, all right, but I mean, at the same time, yeah.
Our brand new Rose of Tralee, ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Limerick, Sinead Flanagan.
The Dome in Tralee on Tuesday night. But on Wednesday morning, Dahi was woken up by Darren and Owen on 2FM Breakfast, and he had a bone to pick about the very high red boots they had made him wear. All in good cause, of course.
Good morning. I've dragged myself out of bed to go into the toilet, so I won't wake my son.
Oh, I thought you could say to wrap my head around the bowl. And...
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm just so tired. I'm going to kill both of you, by the way, when I kind of come around, when I can get the feelings back in my legs after those boots.
Here, I tell you, let's put on some chill music for Dahi, who's... Yeah. We'll talk about the boots in a second. What happens after the cameras stop rolling? Does it turn into Armageddon down there?
The cameras stop rolling. I run after both of you to try kill you. Because youth is on your side, I can't catch you. We have to sit down then and have a few drinks.
A domed out Dahi is heard on 2FM Breakfast. Another year. Celtic Tiger socialite and one-time It boy Gavin Lamb-Murphy spoke to Ryan yesterday, and he had some perspective on conspicuous consumption.
To see people just going in and spending thousands and thousands on, I can actually say it, even though I collapsed on Yves Saint Laurent buying, on crap. It's all crap. Because when I moved out of my house in Ireland, I had Gucci, Dolce, Gabbana, endless. My brother was roaring laughing, going, none of it's even worn. And I was like, it's all crap. That's like, what did I, wasting money? As if wearing a Gucci jacket is going to change your life.
Yeah.
Forget about it.
That's quite an epiphany for you, who was the Gucci boy, the Yves Saint Laurent.
Well, I'm not going to be funny. I'm sitting here wearing Prada, but I mean, you know,
Jesus, nothing changes,
yeah,
really.
I know, but it's old Prada.
This old Prada thing, eh? Well, staying with a certain privileged milieu, Schmidt Happens is the title of the new Ross O'Carroll Kelly book from Paul Howard. And he spoke to Ray Darcy during the week, and it was a particular kind of rugger-bugger that had inspired him to create the character of Ross.
He was born out of, not vitriol, that's too strong a word, but...
Yeah.
But,
no, I don't think, it was vitriol, is it?
Yeah. Is it?
Well, those rugby types just drove me mad, you know? Yeah. I mean, they still do a bit, like, you know, I've probably softened a little bit.
But you can't soften too much.
Because I have to kind of keep the satire hard-edged. It doesn't bother me that they became the fans. The people I was sending up actually became the audience for the character. Only seeing a little bit of themselves in it, but mostly seeing Ciarán and Treloc. That's very like my friend Treloc. And that was a kind of unexpected thing. But yeah, it was really born out of... I had a huge chip on my shoulder about class, I think. I think that's where it comes from. Because I was, you know, working class, from a working class background. Those rugby types, didn't understand them growing up, drove me mad. I told the story before about being stopped from getting on the dart by a kid who told me this is a rock carriage, wouldn't let me in the train and that
College,
kind of thing. And so, I mean, it was born, I suppose, like a lot of satire, it was born out of anger. You know, it was born out of, you know, seeing this world of privilege and wanting to get under those people's skin.
And how does Paul Howard get his likes and his rights down just so?
When I was sitting on the dart or the 46A, I would always listen to language, how sentences were formed, the use of linguistic crutches like and right, the use of the word like in speech attribution. I was like, no way. She was like, way, that kind of thing. Right. And so I've always, and then the raising of the intonation at the end of a sentence. So it sounds like a question.
How do you put that in writing?
I italicize a key word and then a question mark at the end of the sentence. Okay. And that's the upswing. The new one, I've stopped using right about 6 or 7 years ago. It was just starting to grate on me a little bit, because anytime I would tell someone would say, what books do you write? And I say, Rosser Carroll Kelly, they go, oh, Roish. I just became, so I was a bit sick of it. So, but people still say it to me.
Yeah,
but the new one is, yeah, no.
Don't turn your back in your hits.
That's it, yeah. Play Sweet Caroline. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no is the new one.
Yeah,
I'm fine. So I use that quite a lot as well. But
and the quite literally, where would that come in the sentence?
Quite literally, I heard one of the pundits the other day say he was quite literally eating up the ground there, which made me laugh a lot. Quite literally is one of those phrases that just doesn't mean anything anymore. Yes, it's because it's been used incorrectly so much that it doesn't have any meaning whatsoever anymore.
Yeah,
basically.
What basically. Actually.
Actually, I was actually at Electric Picnic.
Yeah, quite literally there on my own.
Basically, yeah.
And finally, what about the state of Schmidt and Co. these days?
Yeah, did you watch it last?
I did.
Last Saturday.
It was hard to watch. Yeah,
yeah. But I suppose it can't get any worse than that, can it?
we said that in 2007.
Paul Howard with Ray. And from the oval ball to the round. Will Dublin succeed in their drive for five, or will Kerry put Sam in their back pocket and head back home to the kingdom? Tomás O'Shea and Ciarán Whelan spoke to John Murray on Friday's Morning Ireland. Here's Tomás on Kerry.
I think the Kerry team will believe they can win. I have no doubt that they have to believe that they can win. They're young, yes, inexperienced, yes, but they are talented. And I think the expectation in general in Kerry is maybe that they are not at the level required to meet this Dublin team as they stand right now. But at the same time, you know, if Kerry go up to Dublin and they do not perform, it will not be accepted.
Janie Mack, no pressure there. Well, what about Ciarán on Dublin's chances?
The one thing when Dublin meet Kerry is they never win easily. And you know, Dublin have never given a thrashing out to Kerry, so you can't have that expectation level as much as they're very hot favourites. From a Dublin perspective, you know, I think the experience will help them. They're very composed. They can deal with adversity. They haven't got off to good starts in the All-Ireland finals in recent years. Their first quarter has been pretty poor, so you'd think that they'd be trying to rectify that. But it really depends how Kerry approach the game. I think Kerry have to be brave and push up and go after Dublin with that talent they have in the forward line.
Oh, that kind of sounds as if Kerry are the underdogs, and we do like an underdog here on Playback. So last word left to the children of the kingdom.
I think they have really good players, and we're going to cheer for them, and we're really going to hope that they win.
No, game on. Now, because you can't have your cake unless you eat your broccoli, It's Brexit time.
We're not going to wait until October the 31st before getting on with our plans to take this country forward. And this is a new government with a very exciting agenda. And to do that, we need new legislation. We've got to be bringing forward new and important bills. And that's why we are going to have a Queen's speech. And we're going to do it on October the 14th. And we've got to move ahead now with a new legislative programme. There will be ample time on both sides of that crucial October the 17th summit, ample time in Parliament for MPs to debate the EU, to debate Brexit and all the other issues.
Sure, ample time, more than enough. That was Wednesday, the day we all learned how to pronounce prorogation, kind of. When Prime Minister Johnson got the Queen to suspend the British Parliament for 5 weeks from mid-September. Anna Soubry, leader of the independent Group for Change, spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan and she was not amused.
I actually feel the need to apologise to your listeners for what the United Kingdom is doing. It's an absolute disgrace. There is no precedent for it and there is no justification for it either.
But Anna Soubry, he blindsided you already. Did none of you think that he might do something like this?
Good God, you bet we did. Of course we did. That's what we've been talking about over the summer and indeed beforehand. Because you may recall that, of course, this was debated during the leadership contest of the Conservative Party. And Johnson wouldn't rule it out. Mm-hmm. And so we have all of us been addressing our minds. There's been legal action, by way of example, in the Scottish courts. So, of course, we have anticipated this. On the one hand, he says there's a one in a million chance of us leaving without a deal. And then in the next breath, he says it's do or die, we're definitely leaving on October the 31st.
But of course, the point is, although many of you, like yourself, Anna, will regard this as an affront to democracy, he is playing by both the letter and the spirit, isn't he?
Oh, he's certainly not playing by the spirit. You must be joking. We're in a national crisis. You don't suspend Parliament. We've just had 5 weeks of recess as it is.
Here's Fine Gael Senator Neil Richmond on the same programme.
The government has been consistent, it has been calm, but in a way it's been blindsided now by the United Kingdom's Prime Minister. And you can only look on and gasp.
Well, I think the UK Prime Minister himself is quite good at blindsiding not only his own Parliament, but himself. Everything that could possibly happen can still happen in the UK. There is no precedent for what is happening either in the UK or indeed in the nature of someone leaving the EU. No one could have predicted 3.5 years ago that there would have been a snap election, that there would have been a DUP involved in a minority government, that Jeremy Corbyn would fail to get any support. He's faced leadership coups in his own party and so much else. All we can do is look after ourselves, control the controllables, which we have continued to do so, not just on an Irish level, but also at a European level, which is vitally important.
But when you speak about, Neil, control the controllables, I mean, there's very little controllables you can control right now.
Oh, that's a fierce amount of control there. Well, the next day, Conservative MP John Redwood spoke to Miriam, and for him, it's less an issue of control and more one of boredom.
We've had a Parliament that's done nothing but discuss Brexit to the point where many of the electors just want it over with and they're getting very bored with the lack of progress and very bored by the lack of any new arguments and new information. It's an argument that isn't going anywhere. The Prime Minister is leaving time for more Brexit debates, if this was what these people really want. But it's decision time now, and that is very welcome from the Prime Minister.
Journalist and Labour Party member Paul Mason responded to the world-weary MP.
Well, what your listeners heard there was the voice of basically not just a man, but a privileged elite who are bored with democracy. It's the kind of atmosphere of ennui that inhabits John Redwood's mind when he thinks about the possibility of our elected representatives actually having a say on the outcome of this crisis. It tells you everything. And I have to say that, you know, if your listeners have been just watching the kind of official news bulletins, they may have missed the big mood change. Because I don't know whether you're familiar with the term gaslighting. Mm. It's a thing online where you try and convince somebody that they're mad.
Yeah.
And what you heard from Redwood there, and it's been going on from other ministers, is this idea that you're mad to think that this is in some way abnormal, that we've suspended Parliament. It's you, the British people, who are mad. Now, it's playing really badly.
And the Irish response is to hold our nerve, keep our heads when all about us are losing theirs and blaming it on us. The wily Bertie Ahern spoke to Mary Wilson.
A few weeks ago, you said you were, I think, a bit frightened because the likelihood of a no-deal Brexit was increasing. How do you feel now?
Yeah, I think even more so, you know, since the holiday period probably came in. There's a new Prime Minister, there's a new Cabinet. It's a pro-Brexit Cabinet. It's not divided as the last one was. We've seen the changes announced in European personnel, which take effect on the 1st of November. The UK government is now reneging on the withdrawal agreement that the same party in government negotiated. We have a Prime Minister saying the backstop must go fully. He's saying it's undemocratic. That's a bit your tongue in your cheek today when you see a prorogue in Parliament. But anyway, let's leave it that. In the letter between Donald Tusk that he sent to Donald Tusk 10 days ago, he said some nice things about the island of Ireland and relationships with Ireland in the first half of his letter. And then he goes on to launch his tirade on the backstop saying that it's undemocratic. So I think there are a whole lot of things that have happened. We get ready for the European Council meeting. It's still 6 weeks away. You know, that's tight. It's not impossible. So I think there are two aspects to this. We have to watch what's happening in Westminster, what's happening in the British political system. But at the same time, I think we have to focus, I think the government here have to focus on the 17th, 18th of October and to see what is the position that we want the European Union to adopt in that and what influence do we want to adopt in that and do we want to give anything? I mean, Angela Merkel and Macron have both said 30 days, you know, to have a look at all of this, but more or less looking at Boris, you come up with the solutions. So I think there is the month of September, so it's not all lost, but there certainly is pressure.
Mary also canvassed the opinion of Boris Johnson biographer Sonia Purnell.
It is very, very difficult to predict the future with him because he, unlike pretty much any other politician in sort of liberal democracy, seems to have no kind of moral breaks. I mean, people, he said that he wouldn't prorogue Parliament or he didn't, the idea didn't appeal to him. And now he's done that. And there are rumours and reports flying around that he might be about to do even more outrageous things to what we call the Constitution. Perhaps you're withholding bills, you know, for royal assent or all sorts of other wargaming that's going on. Because the first time we can no longer say, well, you know, surely he wouldn't do that. Because actually, yes, he might. I mean, he is someone who does not think the rules apply to him. So it is very, very difficult to know where this is going. But it is an extremely dangerous moment for us all here, I'm sure.
Bojo biographer Sonia Purnell, ending our Brexit bit for this week. And musically, it's hard to know how to finish, but I suspect the revellers down at the Electric Picnic won't be too troubled by Brexit. So this one's for them. Get you going. That is it from Playback for this week. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.